Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 129, recorded Thursday, April 27th, 2017. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: airplane fight clubs and the Bourdain effect. So I'm coming to you from the Travel Commons Studios, really the video adjunct of the Travel Commons Studios, because I'm doing another joint video. So I'm videoing this while I am recording it for another Travel Commons Uncut. I think I did this for maybe episode number 114, and that was from, I think, the Sheraton in Framingham, Massachusetts. But this time, we're not in the main Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago. We still are outside of Chicago. We're still in the studios. It's just a nicer video studio. So anyhow, I'm taking a breather this week. The reason I'm doing this in the middle of the week in Chicago, taking a breather from what I like to call stupid travel. Monday, Tuesday in Charlottesville, Virginia, flying out Tuesday night to San Francisco by way of Charlotte, North Carolina, because, well, that's the way the connections worked. Spent Wednesday in San Francisco, complete with a 4 to 5 p.m. meeting, which meant I got to SFO too late for the last reasonable flight to Detroit. I gave up red eyes for Lent many years ago. So instead, I caught the 7 p.m. San Francisco to O'Hare flight, which got me into O'Hare at about 1 a.m., which meant I had to turn around the next morning, head back to O'Hare for a mid-morning flight to Detroit for an afternoon meeting in Ann Arbor. As we were driving out of Detroit Metro to Ann Arbor, I started getting texts from American that our return flight home back to Chicago was already delayed. We hadn't even left the grounds of Metro yet. Later, kind of looking out the window of the meeting room in Ann Arbor, I watched rain just bucket down. And this was kind of the same storm that had blown through Chicago after I had left and put a ground stop at O'Hare. After watching that rain come down, it's like, this delay makes a lot more sense to me. And actually, it wasn't a huge thing for me because, other than extending, quite honestly, already a long week by a couple of hours, I really had nothing else planned than to go home and go to bed. So for Twitter followers, you guys should be pleasantly surprised at that lack of bitch tweets last week. I really didn't think I could complain if this was the only delay in six flights that week. Although I did help my cause by connecting through Charlotte instead of O'Hare for my flight from Charlottesville to San Francisco. The O'Hare San Francisco flight would have been an hour shorter, but I think the probability of actually making that connection was significantly lower. So instead, sort of discretion being the better part of valor, I booked the connection through Charlotte, in spite of the longer total trip duration and that my typically incredibly long walks through Charlotte, because what ends up happening is the regional flights land in Concourse E, which just goes on forever. There's like 35 gates just in that concourse. And, whereas my connecting flights always end up going out of Concourse A all the way on the other side of the airport, which means I'm usually race walking, even with an on-time arrival and a 60-minute connection time. However, on Tuesday night last week, my Charlottesville to Charlotte flight got in early, and my flight actually went out of Concourse B rather than Concourse A, which meant I had more than enough time to score some Carolina barbecue and a tall boy beer. So it really, I'd call it like the good luck trifecta, which probably helped my patience with the Detroit delay 2 days later. First up, thanks to Robert Fennerty for sending along Budapest travel ideas. My wife's parents were refugees from the 1956 uprising, my in-laws. So I've been to Hungary a few times. The first was in 1989 when it was still communist. And then the last time was, I think, about 11 or 12 years ago. So it's been a while. One of Robert's suggestions is to head to the Gayard Baths. Robert says, my favorite, ornate lions dump water into the pool and you can stand beneath the lions. Now, I hit the Gayard Baths my first or second trip to Hungary. There wasn't really any English spoken by the folks there. It's mostly German or Russian. But I had done kind of a Hungarian on tape language course, and I had about 100 words, 100 word vocabulary, not just nouns. I actually had verbs, and I'd worked actually to be able to try and conjugate a couple of those verbs, which in Hungarian is not simple. And so I was actually able to manage buying a ticket and finding the locker room. So, you know, watching the old guys around me, and it was just only old guys. I figured out that I was supposed to strip down and then tie this little white apron around my waist and then head into the baths. High ceilings, the spouting lions, old guys playing chess in the pool. I tell you, I really loved it. I told my son as we were planning for this trip, I said, you know, it's kind of like a Hungarian onsen. And we had been in Japan a couple of years ago and done onsens, had a great time. So we were both, I have to tell you, we were both a bit disappointed when we saw on the Gayart website that the dress code had changed about 4 years ago. So no more single-sex pools, no more aprons, no more old naked guys. That part I could probably skip. It's now co-ed with bathing suits required. And as the website says, all bathers are expected to cover the most important gender essentials. There you go. So not quite the same experience that I had. Chris Christensen sent a quick note about the Munich airport. I was talking about it in the last episode. Chris said, Munich does have its own brewery, but it's outside of security. Chris, a lot of good that did me during my last trip. I actually really could have used a good beer. And kind of continuing on that riff from the last episode, wondering how travel guides are coming up with their top 10 airports. I have to say that SFO, San Francisco Airport, is just, I don't think it's getting the credit it deserves. I think they're doing the best job of any major U.S. airport to remake themselves on the fly. I mean, first, they built a brand new international terminal. Then they rebuilt Terminal 2 into something that I think rivals Hong Kong or Singapore. And they've actually then done a great job of renovating Terminal 3 on the fly, opening up what used to be sort of an overcrowded Newark-like cave. And really, when I was there last week, I was pleasantly surprised. There was a bright, high-ceiling concourse with, you know, really wide walkways. And now they're also now tearing down Terminal 1 to completely rebuild that. So in, I don't know, what, maybe 10 years' time, SFO will have completely rebuilt the passenger side experience, focusing on what I think travelers really need, right? I mean, no water slides or luxury shops, but reasonable security, a great selection of restaurants and bars, lots of seating and workspace, and what was, at least last week, screaming fast 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi. Now, perceptions always lag reality. I mean, that's just the name of the game. But I'm hoping that SFO starts to get what I think would be some well-deserved love on some of these airport ranking lists. One of the podcasts on my subscription list is Men in Blazers. It's a soccer, or for the English listeners, football podcast. And toward the end of each show, the two hosts, Roger Bennett and Michael Davis, quickly review products that they say they're putting in their Amazon Emporium for a little fundraising. One thing that Michael Davis put in some episodes back kind of caught my ear, compression socks. So Michael said he started using them on New York to LA flights and loves them. I got to say, I started using them on international flights after probably about 7 years ago, after a flight home from Hong Kong in United Economy had my legs swelling and stiffening up like tree trunks. I wasn't the only one. There was another guy laying on the floor by one of the exit doors, elevating his legs until a flight attendant came and shooed him off. I couldn't bring myself to lie on an airplane floor, at least not without some sort of sanitized mat. But after that flight, I started flying in compression socks. Not something that I've ever seen make a top 10 travel list. It's not the most exciting tip, but I got to tell you, I swear by it. Maybe I'll sneak it onto my next list. Now, it wouldn't be a complete following up segment without some sort of beer comment. So thanks to Etuck Denver, who tweeted at me, "Mark, next time you're in Denver, we will personally take you on one of our beer tours for all the hours of entertainment provided." Guys, thank you very much. I'm glad you enjoy the podcast. And I look forward to taking you up on that offer. I went spelunking through some websites, through the Etuck website and some linked websites. And it looks like the Etuck guys do beer tours through Denver's Rhino or River North Art District. I guess everybody's got to come up with that like little abbreviated like SoHo kind of thing. The Drink Wino website, you gotta like a district when it's like subdivided and it's got a website just for drinking. The Drink Wino website says they have the largest concentration of craft beverage manufacturers in the United States, with 15 craft breweries, cideries, wineries, and distilleries in a 1 mile radius. Yes, it absolutely sounds like my kind of neighborhood. Hey, and as always, if you have any thoughts, questions, a story, comment, a travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along the email address. As always, comment, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. You can always use your smartphone to record and send in an audio comment. You can send a Twitter message like the Etuck guys did to M. Peacock. You can always post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page or go old school, and post them on the website. It's a WordPress website at travelcommons.com. So the first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is airplane fight clubs. Look, I purposely don't try to do instant Twitter hot takes on the news. The near instantaneous outrage that flares up on Facebook and Twitter often isn't justified when all the facts work their way out days later. And the United Airlines dragging incident and the American Airlines stroller incident, both of these seem to be following those patterns. The April 9th videos of the Chicago Aviation Police dragging a bloodied, semi-conscious passenger down the aisle of a plane, those videos are just awful, let's face it. I mean, there's no two ways about it. But reading the police report that was released 2 weeks after, which at the beginning of this week on the 25th, adds some facts that just are not in the video. That when the officer tried to get the passenger out of his seat, the passenger started, according to the report, swinging his arms up and down fast and violently. Not the best thing to do to a cop. And that this kind of flailing motion knocked off the officer's hands, causing the passenger to fall and hit his mouth on the armrest. And then they took him off. And then after running back onto the plane a second time, he yelled at the cops, "I'm not getting off this plane. Just kill me. I want to go home." Not exactly kind of the Rosa Parks mantle that his lawyer claimed for him at the press conference announcing his lawsuit. Now, United, and actually it wasn't United, it was actually Republic Air, and it was their flight from Louisville operating under United Express banner. And we've talked about this whole thing about how regional airlines kind of really put the major, you know, their brand, the major brands at risk. But anyhow, Republic really just screwed this up in so many ways. I mean, trying to go cheap on the incentives for volunteers, involuntarily bumping passengers who were already on the plane, not figuring out another way to get the deadheading crew down to Louisville, and then escalating to the police, which then led to the passenger escalating. Now, the three other passengers who were also involuntarily bumped took the high road. They kind of grudgingly got off the plane and so as not to inconvenience their fellow passengers, and really to follow the rules that everyone understands are just inviolate since after 9/11. Once you pass through the plane door, you obey the airline and the crew or else. You know, unfortunately, though, for some crew, this expectation of being the unquestioned sort of oracle of right or wrong leads them to demand passengers to respect my authority rather than taking a customer service approach and trying to de-escalate. The American Airlines incident that happened last weekend, a conflict between a flight attendant and a mother of two who, you know, with oversized strollers, that just shows again that that escalation between, in this case, a flight attendant probably trying in a hurry to load a full plane, and a mother trying to bring one or two oversized strollers onto the plane instead of gate checking them, it just quickly spiraled out of control. The conflicting demands between respect my authority and the carry-on rules don't apply to me, they just immediately collide. And it comes out later that the hot take on this, that the flight attendant hit the mother and child with the stroller while trying to take it from her, wasn't true. No one got hit. But that rapid escalation, the mother yelling, threats between the flight attendant and some first class passenger who inserted himself, I mean, that's just everybody's fault. It's an unwillingness for someone to step back, swallow hard, and sacrifice their ego. You know, the lawyer for the United Airlines passengers said in his press conference that the airlines have been bullying passengers. And I have to tell you, I don't think he's completely wrong on this one. I mean, Spirit and Ryanair seem to have built their brands on, you know, how rudely they can treat passengers. But setting those guys aside, the passenger treatment of mainline airlines has eroded in, I think, really in the name of operational efficiency. Packed planes, reduced legroom, flight attendants yelling at boarding passengers to hurry up and sit down so the flight gets out on time. Earlier this week, the American Customer Satisfaction Index reported that the airline industry as a whole remains in the bottom third of all those industries that ACSI tracks. They said customer satisfaction has never appeared to be a goal of the airlines. Compared to other industries, the financial return on passenger satisfaction is not much of an incentive. That's what they said in their report. And, you know, you think about it, as the airline industry has consolidated into an oligopoly of four main carriers in the U.S. and three global alliances, Star Alliance, Oneworld, and SkyTeam, you know, there really aren't that many alternatives. You know, people talked about United passengers boycotting after that April 9th video. But if you live in Houston or you live in Newark, New Jersey, you can't boycott. You don't have an option. At best, you just sort of shrug and bear it. A few lash out, but most of us just try and get on down the road. It's interesting to see, though, United's latest efforts to bury this PR nightmare is a payout to that bloodied passenger in an announcement that they'll now offer up to $10,000 for voluntary rebookings. And Southwest, who've been completely untouched by this, say they'll eliminate overbookings by June. So I don't know. Maybe something good comes out of this. So the second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is the Bourdain effect. That's how travel wags are explaining the explosion of food tourism. People wanting to recreate experiences from Anthony Bourdain's No Reservations and Parts Unknown TV series. Now, it's not that it's anything really new. I mean, people have been going to South Philly forever and flipping a coin between Pat's and Gino's cheesesteaks, or going to Detroit and doing kind of a similar dance between American and Lafayette for Coney dogs. It's more, though, that it's flipped around today. It used to be that you'd, say, come to Chicago to see family or go see a Cubs game, and then, oh, by the way, queue up at Gino's East to try some deep dish pizza. So now it's booking a table at Alinea, which is perennially at the top of the world's 50 best restaurants list, and then booking your flight to hotel and checking the Cubs schedule. You know, food has really become the main draw, with restaurants becoming travel destinations in their own right. Noma, which is the Copenhagen restaurant that is regularly number one at the very top of the world's 50 best list, has taken this to what I think is currently like the most extreme that I've seen. They're doing a pop-up restaurant in Tulum, Mexico, $600 a seat, and they sold out. 5,000 seats sold out in 3 hours. Now, regular listeners know that I'm not immune to this. We've got, my wife and I mean, there's a group of us, we've got three couples, the guys, all of us, we all went to college together. And I got to tell you, we are exhibit A in this trend. So one of the wives, the couple that lives in San Francisco, the wife there found a lunch opening at French Laundry on OpenTable, booked it, then told all of us. All of us immediately then booked for that weekend in Napa. That was it. We hadn't planned to go to Napa before until she found that OpenTable res. It was a great lunch, obviously, three-star lunch, and we're finishing it up, and we kind of look around the table and go, okay, well, what's our next three-star? A couple of months later, my wife booked the kitchen table at Alinea, and the other two couples flew into Chicago. Your travel experts kind of explain this, saying that food is one of the main travel experiences, one of the only travel experiences, maybe. That one I don't buy. But one of the main travel experiences that can't be digitized. Even though a lot of people try, I can't tell you the number of times I've been eating at an upscale restaurant and the guy next to me whips out a big Nikon digital SLR, stands up and shoots his plate. I mean, over a 10-course meal, that, you know, those guys are working off some calories. But of course, you know, you can't digitize taste, and you can't save it. You can only experience it in the moment. It is that truly, it is an existential experience. And that moment isn't just about taste. It's really the whole experience, whether you're doing a three-star lunch in Napa or Chicago or Paris, or it's your first taste of durian, which in and of itself is an experience, at a roadside stand, say in Singapore, or a Chicago hot dog at the Wiener Circle at 2 o'clock in the morning, which is a whole very different experience. One of my favorite memories along this line was with my father. It was many years ago when he and I were down. We went down to Cabo for a week. Charlie Trotter, which is one of the early high-end chefs in Chicago, he had opened a restaurant in the one and only resort, which was between Cabo San Lucas and San Jose del Cabo. My dad and I were actually staying in San Jose del Cabo. Now, I had eaten at Trotter's in Chicago, his main restaurant, a couple of times, actually many times. And I'd even worked a shift in the kitchen. I'd won it in a charity auction. It was a great experience, but it was real work. And so, you know, through this connection, I wanted to try out his new place. They had just opened, and the management actually was all down from the Chicago restaurant. They were kind of shaking things out, and so we said, "Hey, we're from Chicago." Things started out great. The starter courses were really great. But then when the mains arrived, my dad's main course wasn't hot. So I flagged down one of the managers, one of the Chicago guys I've been talking to before. And I asked him if he could just, you know, heat up my dad's dish. woof, away, like both of our plates just like disappear. And then the manager quickly came back. He said, no, we're not reheating it. We're going to remake your dad's plate, a completely new dish. And since you can't be expected to, he can't be expected to watch you eat, or if you sit and wait for him, then your dish will get cold. So we're going to remake yours too, so we can serve them to you at the same time. And while you're waiting, here are a couple more appetizers, you know, appetizer courses just to keep you occupied, and you know, and profuse apologies. So my dad and I kind of looked at each other and then just started, you know, nibbling on the appetizers. And then we finished them. And then our main courses re-arrived hot and fresh. And my dad then looked over, looked down at his dish, looked over the table at me and said, you know, I'm not really that hungry anymore. And I just stared him down. I said, after what they just went through, I said, you're going to eat that dish? All of it, and you're going to like it. It was a complete role reversal from when I was 5 years old. We would replay that scene and laugh about it for years afterwards. And actually, we remembered that scene and would replay it and remember it much more often than we would actually, you know, go look up and pull up pictures of us, you know, outside the giggling Marlin. That's a travel experience that just sort of really sits with me. And now that we're gearing up for our trip to Hungary next month, my wife is, you know, as is her thing, running through the list of top Budapest restaurants. I'm absolutely looking forward to that, actually. I love Hungarian food. But I also remember from our last trips a kind of a steep, narrow walkway in Szentendre, a little town north of Budapest. And there is a little langos stand, deep fried bread, rubbed in garlic, fresh out of the fat, rubbed in garlic with just a bit of cheese on top. Now, I got to tell you, langos didn't make Bourdain's Parts Unknown Budapest episode, but I'll be searching for it all the same. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Counts podcast number 129. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. Check out the show notes for music links. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and iTunes. So we've done 4 months in a row, January through April. I'm probably not going to make it five. My guess is I'm not going to make a May episode. Leave it for Hungary, like I said, next month. And as I've said in episodes before, you got to work to earn that time off. So I'm going to probably be heads down between now and getting on that plane to Budapest, which means we probably won't talk again until June. So check out the website, and that's why I've made the uncut video, just as a little hold you over until June. You know, as always, thanks for everybody who sends stuff in. If you've got a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, and Peacock on Twitter. There's the Facebook wall. Did they still call it a wall? I don't know. There's a Facebook page. And then there is the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everybody, as always, Robert Fennerty, Chris Christensen, all the folks who tweet at me. Really appreciate it. Until we talk again, which, like I said, sorry, I don't think that's going to be until June. Travel safe, take care, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.